The second case for oral argument this morning is Halls v. White. For the appellant, Halls is Patrick Ginsbach, an attorney from Hot Springs, and for the appellees, White is Mr. Timothy Thomas, an attorney from Rapid City. Justice Zinner has disqualified himself from this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Lori Wilbur, Circuit Judge from the 6th Judicial Circuit here in Pierre, to sit in his place. Mr. Ginsbach, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Pat Ginsbach, and I, along with my associate Heather Sudbeck, represent Marvin Halls, the plaintiff and appellant in this case. I've been practicing law for 25 years when this case walked into my office, and it's the first time in 25 years when I looked up in the law books, I found previous cases that met the same facts that were presented to me by my client. And that was that this case had in 1981 and again in 1983 under similar facts found that even though restrictive covenants didn't define mobile home, the legislature had, and by using that definition, the dwelling, much like the manufactured home that the Whites want to put on the subdivision, were precluded under the restrictive covenants. Now, I read my briefs over last night, and I thought, you know, my problem always has been is I've never hit the nail on the head. I always beat around the bush. I whisper, stare decisis, stare decisis. I quote you Farnham versus Evans and Vaughn versus Eggleston, those two cases. But I never really point out that, you know, you've got a precedent here. You've got two of them. Farnham versus Evans, which was decided in 1981 under similar facts, and then 2 years later, after the legislature repealed the definition of mobile home and inserted it with manufactured homes, still relied upon the decision in Farnham versus Evans to conclude that you couldn't place a manufactured home in a subdivision that prohibited mobile homes. You know, and you know, the recently with the Supreme Court decisions and the confirmation hearings of Justice Alito, we learned a lot about stare decisis. So I went back and I looked at some of the laws and the principles, and the doctrine has deep meaning, not only in this state, but nationwide. And that is that we should hold firm to those precedents unless there are facts that are not similar to the precedent that's been established, or there's an overwhelming reason to overturn that precedent. Now, in this case, the three things that I want to argue, of course, are the issue that this previous rulings of this court should be controlling and mandate that the White's mobile home or manufactured home should be excluded from Pine Haven subdivision. Second thing I wanted to cover is that the clean hands doctrine should not apply to my client in this case. And the third one is that the restrictive covenants are in effect and are valid and enforceable. Now, the facts in this case are that in 1976, a developer in Hot Springs bought some land outside of the town called Pine Haven Subdivision. He hired a surveyor to subdivide it, had a plat prepared, and had that plat recorded at the courthouse. The subdivider then went down to Alan Wilson, a lawyer who had practiced law in Hot Springs for a number of years, and had him prepare some restrictive covenants. He signed those covenants, and in those covenants, he provided that those covenants would be binding upon, you know, would run with the land. He had them recorded at the Register of Deeds office, and he proceeded to try to sell his lots. And we admit that it's taken him 29 years, and he still has lots that he hasn't sold. But in those 29 years, people relied upon those restrictive covenants, and all of the homes that have been built out there up until 2005 were stick-built homes or modular homes. He sold a lot to the Whites, and the Whites knew about the restrictive covenant on mobile homes because they specifically provided in their purchase agreement that it was contingent, that sale, upon them being able to provide and place a 28-foot by 72-foot manufactured home on that lot.
Now, so what is the landowner's remedy at that stage?
The landowner being the Whites?
The landowner being the person who put the restrictive covenants on the lots.
Well, I think he had two alternatives available to him. One is he could have went to the other owners of the subdivision and said, look, I have this opportunity. They have a manufactured home. Here are the dimensions and the specifics about it. Would you waive that covenant requirement and put that in writing? But he didn't do that. The other thing he could have done is he could have brought a declaratory judgment action and named the other owners in the subdivision and asked the court to take an interpretation as to whether or not that restrictive covenant applied in this case under these circumstances.
Isn't there a third remedy?
I can't think of that.
Well, under the covenants themselves, there's a provision that allows them to change the covenants.
That's correct.
In the future.
By a majority of the landowners
right.
can amend
so
the covenants.
So a simple majority of the landowners could have changed the covenants to eliminate that's mobile homes.
That's correct. Okay. So there were, yeah, you're correct. There were three remedies. And there was some dispute that the appellees raised that the language was unclear as to whether or not those covenants could be amended until after 30 years of their adoption, and they were filed for recording in November of 1976. My client and the witnesses that testified said that they read them, that they could be amended at any time by a majority of the landowners, and that was not done, and the permission was not sought or a declaratory ruling brought. In the Farnham versus Evans case, much like this case, there was no definition of mobile home. And in that at that time, the Supreme Court relied upon a statutory definition provided by the legislature. And we believe that it's still good law to follow that, that you should look to what the definitions were of a mobile home at the time that the covenants were enacted. And you can look at the legislative history or the legislative pronouncement. And the reason you look at that is because it gives you a guide as to what the circumstances were and what was going on at that time when those covenants were enacted, why Mr. Wilson didn't go on to define mobile home. And quite reasonably, like this court did, it looked to those contemporary legislative enactments and the other documents that used the term and defined the term of mobile home to reach the conclusion that a mobile home had a definition in South Dakota.
Is there any indication that manufactured homes were even in existence in 1974 whenever these were put in?
Well, if you look at the history of the national legislation or the federal legislation, it appears that the manufactured home concept or the legislation providing for them and the HUD requirements came into effect, I think, in 1980 or 81. And then subsequent to that, the states picked up on that legislation and adopted the definition of manufactured home. And
so then my next question is, how could the definition of mobile home that was written in 1974 include manufactured home if that really wasn't even a concept or a possibility at that time?
Well, because you'd look at the structure itself, and the structure of the manufactured home hasn't changed that much from a mobile home. You know, it's moved down the highway. It's designed to be moved down a public highway. So the dimensions are anywhere from 12 to 14 feet wide, from anywhere from 65 to 72 feet long.
Having lived in a trailer house, is what I would have called it, many years going to school and so forth, it is definitely different. I mean, you could pull the skirtings out, pull up a truck and pull it off and move it. That's not true of these, is it?
It is true with these.
No, but is there are there wheels?
There are wheels that can be taken off and reattached if you want to move it.
But they aren't part of the house itself. I mean, a trailer house, that was all part of it. It truly was a trailer house that you could hook up and haul it away.
But even with the trailer house, you could take the axles off, much like Mr. Olstead testified and Mr. Erskine. In this case, the structure of the manufactured home that the Whites brought in came in with a tongue attached to it, with axles on the steel beam, and with wheels so it could be moved down the highway.
How do they move these houses that the governor builds? Are those attached to wheels too and hauled down the highway?
Well, I
put
think
those on some kind of. I mean, then would they become trailer houses as well?
No, because it's a lot like what Mr. Olstead testified in the court. The difference between that is that with a mobile home or a manufactured home, the chassis itself serves as the foundation. That's why you can't remove that, because it would all collapse in on itself. With the governor's house, the four walls, they're designed to sit on a perimeter foundation. That's not the case with a manufactured home or a mobile home. They are designed to be tied down underneath those steel beams to pylons or piers poured underneath it. In this case here, they poured a perimeter concrete around the manufactured home, but it was just to attach the skirting to. It wasn't to set the foundation on. and they still had the I-beam underneath there so that they, as Mr. Olstead said, could come back at any time in the future, jack it up, attach the axles and the wheels back to it, reattach the tongue, and move it down the highway. So we believe that it does fall within the definition of being a mobile home that was in existence back in 1974 and 1976. The other issue I'd like to move into is the issue of whether or not my client came to this court or came to the lower court with unclean hands and sought equitable relief. There was testimony, and he admitted that he had bought a lot for out at Pine Haven Subdivision. He'd owned another home that he was living in, and that home that he lived in was sold. And so he moved a mobile home onto his lot while he built his stick-built house. But he also testified that he went to the neighbors who had homes built out there and asked for their permission to begin with, verbally. He had told them it would not be a permanent structure, it was just temporary, until he got his house constructed. He didn't even wait until his house was constructed to move it off the lot. He had an opportunity to move somewhere else. He moved out of that mobile home, removed the mobile home, and the mobile home had been gone for some years before he came to this court and sought relief. Now, I couldn't find any South Dakota cases about purging yourself from your unclean hands. I did find cases in other jurisdictions. And the things that they said you look at is whether or not the person who has the unclean hands has done something to try to remove himself from the offending conduct. And in that case here, I think the Indiana court that I cite showed a woman was operating a daycare facility in a subdivision that prohibited daycare facilities. She ceased operating that, a period of time had passed, and another woman opened up a daycare facility, and she sought relief under the covenants to prohibit that other business. And the Indiana court said, yes, she probably did have unclean hands at one time, but she purged herself. She didn't engage in fraud or deceit, neither did Mr. Halls. He went to his neighbors, he told them what he was going to be doing, and they accepted his position and what he did. He followed through on it. And that he did remove the mobile home. And by the time that he came into court, the offensive conduct had stopped or ceased to exist. The case cited by the appellees, which is a Saudi case, is somewhat distinguishable because in that case, the Saudi corporation, even though it had been ruled that it engaged in offensive conduct, still sought equity relief from another court, but still pursued its remedies to the Supreme Court on an appellate decision to try to get that its offending conduct was permissible. And the court in the Saudi versus Exxon case said, you can't do that, you know. And they make much of the fact that my client isn't a repentant sinner, but he is a repentant sinner. He removed the offending object from the subdivision, and he's abided by the terms of the covenant since that time. The last issue that I wanted to cover is whether or not these covenants are valid and effective. And that was the argument that was raised by the Whites at the trial court level, rejected by the trial court. But they said that you can't, as an individual of owner of land, burden your own land with covenants and expect to enforce them later on. But that's clearly what this court has decided in other cases. And I cite this court to Pytowski versus Case, in which the same thing, a developer had come forward, much like in this case, platted his property out, created the covenants, placed those covenants on the land, and then sold them to subsequent purchasers. And as the cases that I cited in my brief state, there are three factors that you look at in determining whether or not those covenants are valid and enforceable. And that's whether or not they run with the land, and clearly the covenants state that that's the intent. The second thing is whether or not the covenants affect the subsequent owner's use of that land, and clearly they do in this case. They restrict what you can place on it. And the third one, whether or not there's privity of estate between the person who creates the covenants and between the subsequent people that purchase. And in this case here, Mr. Shellstead created the covenants, and then he subsequently sold those to the people who built the homes in the subdivision. For these reasons, we're asking the court to follow its prior rulings in Farnham versus Evans and Vaughn versus Eggleston and mandate that manufactured home that the Whites wish to place in Pine Haven subdivision is prohibited under those restrictive covenants. If there are no other questions.
I have a question. Would you address the whole issue of whether or not this is ambiguous? I know you're relying upon these other cases and the statutes, but what the what directs us is to try to determine what that covenant means. And, of course, we're directed here specifically to what is a mobile home. I think, if I'm not mistaken, the trial court determined that that was ambiguous and allowed the drafter or the person who initially, what was his name, Mr.
Shelstead,
to testify as to what he meant. And clearly, he does not support your interpretation of it. It would appear to me from the findings of fact that the trial court relied upon that.
That's correct.
So what's wrong with that?
Well, if you follow...
Are we saying that he's clearly erroneous, or that the trial court was clear, or she, I guess it was Janine Kern, was she clearly erroneous in making that determination?
Yes, and that she had erred as a matter of law, in that your rules of construction on when a contract is ambiguous is when you apply those rules of interpretation, do they leave you with a genuine uncertainty as to which of two or more meanings is correct? And that's not the case here. The Whites could not point out to the court what the two different meanings were of mobile home. They just contended we have a manufactured home. But they didn't look at the definition or the meaning of mobile home that was in existence when those covenants were issued. And our contention is that their structure falls within that definition. It's a chassis designed to be moved down a highway, and it can have axles and wheels attached and removed and reattached for moving later on. It's still a mobile home, whether you call it a manufactured home or not. And so she erred in determining if there was uncertainty. The other thing that you'd look at, why we think that you look just to the legislative enactments instead of the developer's own testimony, is it was self-serving. He's been out there for 29 years trying to sell these lots. He had his own realtor testify. Well, we had his realtor testify that if he'd known he could have put mobile homes or manufactured homes out there, he'd have sold those lots out years ago. But he wasn't able to do so. He'd read those covenants, and the realtor interpreted the covenants to prohibit the use of dwellings such as the Whites wanted to move on to that subdivision. The other thing is that Mr. Shelstead's own reasoning isn't logical. He says, well, when he meant mobile home, he meant to exclude bumper-type pole travel trailers and motorized self-contained motorhomes. And yet the covenants themselves clearly allow for the storage of those bumper-type travel trailers on the subdivision. So when he says, well, that's what I meant to exclude, and yet in the definition, when he's defining mobile homes and what's allowed and what's not allowed, he allows those bumper-type pole trailers to be stored there. So that's why we think that the court erred and there was no ambiguity.
Okay, if that's the case, she still goes through her findings of fact and goes through all of the definitions of mobile home, but seems to rely heavily on the difference here in that the mobile home has no reference to a foundation while a manufactured home does. What's clearly erroneous about that?
Well, the foundation that she talks about is it's the same type of foundation for a mobile home, and that is that you tie down those steel girders to pylons or piers poured underneath the steel girders, not a perimeter-type foundation that you'd expect to find on a modular or stick-built house. And clearly here, the testimony was that the perimeter foundation that they'd poured wasn't down to frost level, so that it could buck and weave with the ground as the frost came and went, but it was merely to be there to tie into the skirting for the manufactured home.
And you're saying her finding is clearly erroneous in that regard?
Correct. Are there any other questions?
Guess not. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Thomas, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tim Thomas. I represent the appellees in this case, Jerry and Janet White. Were the owners of the manufactured home that they had attempted to place in the Pine Haven subdivision. The first thing I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the standard of review since that wasn't discussed at all. The posture of this case is the denial of an injunction. And the standard of review in denial of an injunction is the same as grant of an injunction, and that's abuse of discretion. And there's a two-part test that you look at. Number one, were any facts clearly erroneous? Number two, if not, taking those facts as true, did the court then abuse its discretion? Now, in a recent case, Prairie Hills Water, this was described as discretion exercised to an end or purpose not justified by or clearly against reason and evidence. And then further went on to talk about abuse of discretion with a judicial, abuse of judicial discretion. The court said, when this court reviews a matter involving judicial discretion, the test is whether we believe a judicial mind, in view of the law and the circumstances, could reasonably have reached the conclusion. So I think that's, you know, the standard view we have to look at here is whether Judge Kern abused her discretion in denying this injunction. First, the testimony about Gary Shelstad's testimony, who's a drafter of the covenants and the owner. Number one, this testimony wasn't just made up for purposes of this proceeding. His testimony has been consistent over the years. If you look at his deposition, when they placed a modular home and they asked him if they could place a modular home in this particular subdivision, he said, as long as it meets the foundation requirement and the square footage requirement, that's what I'm looking for. I don't consider that to be mobile if it's on a foundation, and that's in Mr. Shelstad's testimony. And so his testimony, which the court allowed in, finding an ambiguity, is clearly relevant to the decision of what is a mobile home here. Now, the testimony that Mr. Ginsbach spoke of the realtor, that, well, we could have sold all these out if we'd known mobile homes weren't here, that's pure speculation. And he testified at the trial. He never even talked to Gary Shelstad, didn't know who wrote the covenants, never spoke with Gary Shelstad about what the covenants meant. Same way with the testimony of Mr. Olstad, that Mr. Ginsbach mentioned that the perimeter footing on this mobile home was not down to the frost level. That's just not true. The testimony at the trial, Mr. Olstad, who was Hall's own witness, said, I hauled the concrete out there, but I didn't go look. I never went there after I hauled the concrete out. I did not measure any of the piers. And the testimony of the contractor who actually set the manufactured home down says two of the exterior perimeter foundation walls were down below frost level, 42 inch. So,
two of them or four of them?
Two of them on the perimeter walls. Now there's a pad of concrete piers that are in the go down the middle of the structure where the steel beams sit on. And those are down below frost level also. Plus, it's tied down with lag bolts to these concrete piers that are 42 inches in the ground.
I assume you're talking about the sides then?
Yes.
Then, but they did not put the foundation below the frost line on the ends.
There was two sides, and I can't remember if they were the sides or the front and back. But I know there was two sides, the exterior sides, that were down to the frost line. And then
the other two were not.
I believe that's correct. And then the concrete foundation is built up so that it's underneath, and it appears as a just as a any type of home that you would drive by on the street. In fact,
well, that isn't true. On a home that you drive by on a street requires a going below the frost line 42 inches wherever it's built, right?
Well, that would probably be correct if there were building codes. In this case, there were no building code even applied in Pine Hill Subdivision. I mean, that's one of the ironic things here.
Well, but that's what you're comparing it to, a house that complies with the building code, and
right.
But we've got two ends here or two sides, we don't know which,
right,
which are not below the frost line on
that's
the foundation.
True. That's true. But the anchors of the house certainly are. And to get back to the issue of...
So do you agree with Judge Kern's findings of fact that everything except the foundation meets the mobile home definition?
Well, the I think you have to look at her findings of fact. Yes, I agree that they were correct. You have to look at the posture of this case in that after the Farnham decision, the legislature passed a different definition called manufactured home. Now, if they had replaced mobile home with manufactured home, this would be a different story, but they didn't. They kept the definition of mobile home that the Farnham Court used. It's still there. It's not in the same place, but it's in 32-3-1, subsection 8. And to this day, and manufactured home is in subsection 6 of that same statute. So we've got a statute that contains two different definitions, and the legislature has maintained this distinction from this day forward. This distinction between these two statutes continues in many different statutes in the state. One of them, which I think is very important, is in a taxing statute, they define manufactured home as real property, and that's 10-4-2.4, I believe. And it says a manufactured home as defined in, I think, 32.1.3, subsection 6, is in fact real property. Now, I realize that's for purposes of taxation, but if you look...
So is this taxed as real property?
At the time that this of the posture of this case, the house hadn't even been set down. So the testimony was that it would have been taxed as real property, but at the time it wasn't. It also was going to be financed by a real estate mortgage, a 30-year mortgage. There's also testimony. We've heard about modular homes, the Pine Hill subdivision allowing modular homes. There's exhibits in the record of a modular home, which is the exact same model as the White's manufactured home, that's identical to the White's manufactured home. They allowed modular homes in Pine Hill subdivision. If this had been a modular home, it obviously would have been allowed in Pine Hill subdivision.
So what's the difference there?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. It's an arbitrary distinction as far as I know, because the testimony from the contractors that testified, even Mr. Olstead, the Hall's contractor, was that you could not tell by driving by the street and looking at a home, whether it's a modular home or a manufactured home. The only way you can tell the difference is to crawl underneath and see if the steel beam is still in place. That way, if the steel beam is still in place, then it's a manufactured home. If not, then it's a modular home. But you can't tell the difference from the outside.
Well, does the steel beam have anything to do with the portability of it?
Well, it's the method of moving the structure to the place where it's going to be placed permanently, or would be placed permanently in almost every case. I cite a couple cases in my brief which talk about, well, there's actually the facts in one case where they found the particular manufacturer testified there, and one out of 160 manufactured homes had been moved since they moved to the original site. One out of 160. The other one case talked about the national statistics being 1-3%. So when you talk about mobility, we certainly do not have mobility in the case of this manufactured home. In fact, the findings of fact that Judge Kern set down was that it would be very difficult to move once it was set down. And that was based upon the testimony of the White's contractor, who said it would be more difficult to move than a modular home. Because with a modular home, you can basically knock holes in the foundation, slide steel beams under there, jack it up, and drive it off. You can do that with any home. In a prior life, I used to work for a house mover, and that's what we did. I mean, you get a sledgehammer, you start knocking holes in the concrete, and you slide steel beams under there and jack it up and drive it off. You put wheels underneath and drive it off. So any home is mobile in a sense. So I mean, I don't think that is controlling here, especially when this manufactured home and the findings of fact that Judge Kern set down were that it would be very difficult to move once it's set down, and perhaps more difficult to move than a modular home. That's in her findings of fact, I think paragraph number 33. The Farnham case that we talked about, that Mr. Ginsbach talked about, which I need to address here, is the difference there. Obviously, we got a different statute here, which we've talked about. And Farnham was, basically they said, well, at the end of the decision, we could speculate on the wisdom of a zoning restriction permitting a modular home and precluding a pair of mobile homes, which form into a modular type. However, the reasons for the covenant are not before us. Okay, that's the difference. In Farnham, they did not have the reasons for the covenant in front of them. We do here. We have the testimony of the drafter of the covenants as for the reason of the covenants. And they clearly do not intend to apply to the White's manufactured home.
Am I missing something? It seems to me that you said at one point the landowner didn't have anything to do with drawing the covenants, and now you're saying that he's the drafter of the covenants?
No, the landowner did draft the covenants. The person I was talking about that didn't have anything to do with it was Mr. Russ Wyatt, who was the Hall's...
The realtor?
The realtor, who was the Hall's witness. He had nothing to do with drafting them, never talked to the drafter, didn't know who drafted them. I mean, his testimony was based on his understanding of what they meant, his subjective understanding of what they meant. So,
but the truth of the matter is that manufactured homes weren't probably even in existence at the time these were drafted, isn't that?
Well, they certainly were not defined by statute in South Dakota, that's correct. I think Mr. Ginsbach indicated that on a national level, there were some national standards set forth for
but that was like
HUD
certification. A decade later.
Yes, to meet HUD certification, which was, I believe, in the 1980s. So, the fact that the covenants do not mention manufactured home, that's a reason in and of itself to say, or to determine that the covenants are ambiguous. There are several cases that the court could have relied on that says if you do not define mobile home, that in itself is an ambiguity. If you go through the covenants themselves and you don't take paragraph 5 out of context, you will see that the intent, by looking at the entirety of the covenants, is placement of a minimum square foot size structure on a concrete foundation. And obviously the White's mobile home met the square foot requirement, is 1989 square feet, and it was placed on it only requires, paragraph 4 requires a concrete or cement block foundation. So it obviously meets those requirements. The Farnham cases, if you look at it, you have to conclude that in that case, although there was no discussion of it, but the Farnham court must have determined that the term mobile home was ambiguous in that case, otherwise they would not have looked to a statutory definition. In other words, they went to extrinsic evidence to determine what was meant. There's a recent...
So do we have to do that here, too?
I believe that's the case, yes. There's a recent case, Vollmer versus Ockerson case, where it's a 2004 case, and the facts of that were there was a claimed ambiguity in a contract, an employment contract, and in order to interpret it, the appellant argued that we should look at what does the statute define as termination? Well, this court said, no, you don't. We look at the four corners of the document. We're not going to look at a statute because it's extrinsic evidence. And what the Farnham court did was look at extrinsic evidence. It looked at what it had at the time, which was a mobile home, a definition of mobile home. Now, as I've stated, we now have a definition of manufactured home.
So I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if we don't go to the ambiguity and say it's not ambiguous, then, I mean, it's possible if you didn't find it to be ambiguous that it wouldn't necessarily even be the statute that defines a mobile home would not even apply to these covenants.
Right.
But you don't agree, you think that we would have to go to a determination that it's ambiguous.
Well, I think that's what Judge Kern did. I mean, she found it ambiguous. And I think that she was legally correct in that case. Now, I think you could read the plain language of the statutes, and by...
Does mobile home just have a plain and ordinary meaning? Because if we didn't say it was ambiguous, then you could just look at the plain and ordinary meaning of it.
Plain and ordinary meaning, I think if you look at the number of cases around the country, and I think there's 32 jurisdictions that have confronted this question, or a similar question, it varies. I don't know that there's one meaning that everybody's going to agree on, and that's what a mobile home is. The problem is it could mean both a structure and a vehicle, and that's what one of the cases say. This is why it's ambiguous, because it can mean a structure and a vehicle. And
but do you take it in the context of 1974?
If you take it in the context of 74, I think, you know, mobile home in that era was probably a single wide crank out window with aluminum siding and tires on the top, with the wheels permanently attached, so that you could remove the skirting, stick the hitch on the back of your pickup and take off. That's what I think of. Now, that's only my opinion, but I think there's some cases that say the same thing in other jurisdictions. There's some spotted cow cases, later 1990-2000 cases in other jurisdictions that are exactly on point here. Let me mention the Vaughn case that Mr. Ginsbach said controls either. That's clearly distinguishable. The covenants in that case says no building shall be moved on to allow a lot from outside, except new modular buildings. Well, okay, no building shall be moved on. That's what the court in that case hung its hat on, was that particular section of the covenants. The Pikowski case really... Well, let me mention one other thing. There's Ludtke versus Carlson, which I cite for the proposition that zoning ordinances are to be strictly construed. And I realize that Pikowski says, well, we didn't adopt that. And that was dicta. Well, if you look at the Ludtke case, the reason it's dicta is because they didn't rely on it. They recognized the general rule. They didn't rely on it. They also set down another rule. They said enlarging the ordinance or restrictive covenants to inhibit a use is a function not resting with the courts. That's what we would be doing here. If you enlarge the covenant to encompass a manufactured home which didn't exist at the time, you'd be enlarging the use of the covenants. Plus, there's two subsequent cases in South Dakota, Sioux Falls versus Cleveland, City of Sioux Falls versus Cleveland, that do say, they do adopt the rule set forth in Ludtke, that well-founded doubts as to the meaning of obscure provisions of a zoning ordinance should be resolved in favor of the free use of property.
Your time has expired, Counsel.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Ginsbach, you have 10 minutes.
I think Justice Meyer Henry maybe hit the nail on the head, and that is the distinction is portability or mobility. That's what the Farnham case talks about, is whether they're designed to be portable or movable or mobile. And that's clearly the case here. The manufactured home that Mr. White's clients have a steel beam on it. that continues to stay there. And it may be there 10 years or 15 years or 20 years, but if you want to move that manufactured home, all you have to do is kick out those concrete blocks, reattach the axle and the wheels to the steel beam, and off it goes. The difference between that and the modular home is that the steel beam isn't an integral part of the modular home. It's only there for one purpose, and that's to move it. Once it gets to its location, and with a modular home, it can be not just two sections, it can be a number of sections that can be moved down the highway. You take it off of the steel beam and you set it on a perimeter foundation. And that perimeter foundation becomes the anchor, the chassis for the home. That's different than the manufactured home. Like the mobile home, the manufactured home's foundation is its chassis, that metal steel beam running down the length of it. As Mr. Olstead testified, if you were to remove that, like you did on a modular home, the manufactured home would collapse in on itself because it's a chassis that this court recognized back in 1981 and 1983 that creates the mobility. And you can anchor it all you want, but it still has that mobility and it allows it to be moved. That's why we believe that those two cases are still controlling precedent, and you should go back and you should use the statute that was in existence when those covenants were adopted. That's the ordinary and plain meaning of a mobile home, what the legislature adopted and what people followed. That's why there was no definition for it. It's not ambiguous. And that's what the Gajkowski versus Russell case in Texas did. You know, they had the manufactured home and they said, look, we look at the structure and does it still contain its mobility? And it does. And the Gajkowski court said, we look at what the definitions were that were in existence when the restrictive covenants were adopted. And there was a legislative enactment in the Texas case too. And so they relied upon that legislative enactment defining mobile homes to conclude that manufactured homes, if they meet those definition requirements of mobile home, fall within that restrictive covenant.
Now, Judge Curran, back to your chassis argument, she made a finding here that, I mean, she did base it partly on whether or not the chassis, this particular home had a chassis, and she included it did not because of the definition included wheels, and that the manufactured home chassis does not include wheels. The axles and wheels, she says, were not part of the purchase price, and they were removed upon setup. So she did take that into consideration, whether or not it had a chassis.
Well, and we contend that her finding there is clearly erroneous because it had the chassis. It's like a car. You can take the wheels off it, but it's still a car with a chassis.
Okay, but is that an argument, though? I mean, she made this finding. She listened to all the evidence and made the finding.
That
I assume you argued that to her.
Correct. That there was, as you pointed out on your questions to Mr. Thomas, and that was the mobility factor, that it was portable. It still retains its portability because unlike the modular home, you're going to have to bring in a house mover to move that. With a manufactured home or a mobile home, all you have to do is to reattach the axle and the wheels. As Mr. Olstead testified, it was very common until recently with the high prices of steel that the axle and the wheels were thrown underneath the manufactured home and left there for later use. Now at the cost of steel, he said that was becoming more cost prohibitive, but that just meant that you now have the axles and the wheels to rent or to use from the mobile home mover to get your mobile home or your manufactured home moved out of the subdivision. Yes, again, what we contend is that there was no ambiguity, that you used the plain meaning of the term mobile home as it existed back in 1976 when those covenants were drafted, and that's what's available from the legislature. This is what this court had done back in 1981 when Mr. Shellstead had the opportunity to define what he meant by mobile home and didn't. And so now for the court to step outside and consider his testimony is clearly erroneous. By the plain meaning of the statute, by the plain meaning of the covenants and the statutes that were in existence, you could find what the definition of a mobile home was. Apply that definition. As we believe that if the court had applied that definition, they would find that the manufactured home fits within that definition. It has a chassis.
So do you agree then that in order to even use the statute, we'd have to first decide that it was ambiguous?
No, you wouldn't. You have to determine what
if you can't look at the four corners of the document and determine the meaning, and you have to look at extrinsic evidence, would you not, wouldn't you have to say then, I can't tell by looking at this document and that it's ambiguous, and then from there go to extrinsic evidence, which is the statutory definition? Wouldn't you first have to do the ambiguity question?
I don't think you do, because you have to determine, if you look at that four corners of that document, do you have a common ordinary meaning, an understandable meaning of that term? And that's what the court said. There's a common understandable meaning. The legislature's adopted.
If there is, we wouldn't go to the statute and use it, unless we're saying that that's the common ordinary meaning, but they define it far more in detail.
I think what the reason that the court went to the statute was to confirm that the issue was in those restrictive covenants is to prohibit structures or dwellings that are mobile, that are mobile, that have that mobility factor. And that's what you look at. Do they have the mobility conditions of the structure of the dwelling? And here this clearly does. It has a place where you can attach a tongue or you can remove that tongue. And it has the steel beams still underneath it, so you can attach the axle and the wheels. So what the Supreme Court found in 1981 was the issue was, it doesn't matter if you anchor it down, like Farnham did, it's still mobile. It still has its characteristics to be able to move down the highway easily with just reattaching the wheels, the axles, and the tongue, and hooking onto it and pulling it out.
Did Farnham determine it was ambiguous?
No. Did not. So for those,
if we reverse as you would like us to, and determine that the manufactured home is covered by the term that was in the covenant mobile home, what does that mean for the statutory scheme that's in place now, where we have a definition of manufactured home and we also have a definition of mobile home? I'm having some trouble.
Well, I don't think that really affects the statutory scheme as far as the application of restrictive covenants, because you're looking at the restrictive covenants that were created back in 1976. If I go outside a pier and I purchase a piece of rural land today, obviously when I draft my restrictive covenants, I'm going to take into consideration that there are manufactured homes, there are mobile homes. I think as the Gajkowski Court says in Texas, they started out calling them trailer homes, trailer houses. But because of the negative connotations of that term, then it commercially developed into mobile homes. And then again, because of the negative connotations of mobile homes, they developed into manufactured homes. But they're still mobile. That's the underlying characteristic. And so I think that's the distinction, is you have to go back as to what is in existence in 1976, and if that dwelling falls within that definition, I don't care if you call it a modular home or a manufactured home, it's still prohibited by those covenants. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Court will be in recess until 11 o'clock.